Hi, everybody. My name is Yvonne Schley. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. What a lovely event, huh?
Yeah.
It is a pleasure to be here. Sammy and I drove up from Los Angeles today. It was a very easy drive, no worries. It's lovely to be here at this ice cream social, and I love the energy and enthusiasm, and I'd like to thank the committee, Johnny, for inviting me to come up here, and Sammy for accompanying me today. I know that there are a lot of newcomers here, and I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always like to say up front, because as you'll hear, I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want you to know, if you're new, that I am not one of those people that came in here feeling like this was home. I didn't want what you had. I didn't want to join any bowling leagues. I just thought Alcoholics Anonymous was about the lamest thing that I could ever do. And I hated my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that my mommy sent me to when I was 13 years old. And you'll hear very quickly why my mother sent me to AA when I was 13. And I hated every single meeting. And in fact, I hated Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here on February 10th, 1994. As a result of what happened here in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life began to change, and I eventually fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I came here with a really bad attitude, hoping this wasn't contagious. So if you're new, welcome. Welcome if you're my people, if you don't want to be here. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm adopted. I don't really care about that, but my mother would like you to know I don't come from alcoholics. God, my mother, my poor, sweet, sweet mother wanted a third child so badly, and she chose the wrong one, I can tell you. It was good for me, though, because she was the perfect mother for me. She could have done much better herself, though. So I'm the only alcoholic in my family. My parents are very, they were very sweet people, very sweet, decent people. I was raised well. I have, my brother is their natural child, and he's perfect. my brother in a nutshell, right? When he graduated high school in June, he went to college in September. And he graduated, you know, the 3.5 years later that people usually do, well, you know, that non-alcoholics do. You know, he graduated on time. He and his wife are married almost 31 years. They met in college. They've been together since, right? I always remember their anniversary, which is Christmas Eve. 31, this year will be 31 years ago, and the only reason I remember is because I was 8 months pregnant, and I was in the bathroom getting loaded at their wedding. So every year I'm like, oh yeah, they'll be 32 years married, because it took me a year and a couple of months after that to get sober. But in any event, my brother, you know, sweet. My sister, also non-alcoholic, but I'm so grateful for her. My sister's priest thinks she ought to go to Al-Anon. She loves alcoholics, and I was her favorite until she had some of her own. My sister got me drunk when I was 4 years old. She was 12. But when my sister was 12, she was 5'10½", so she passed for a lot older. And when I was 4, I thought my sister was a grown-up, you know? She had blonde hair. She still does. She has blonde hair and green eyes. She was so beautiful, and I wanted to be just like her when I grew up. And I got to go somewhere with her, and I got to drink a bunch of beer. And I remember the feeling of that beer, because I remember a few things. I remember that feeling of, like, the dizziness, right? I liked the taste of beer, and I love that feeling. But my favorite part of the whole thing is what happened afterwards, which is that my sister always told people, she was so proud of me, and she would say, my little sister can drink big guys under the table. And today I know I wasn't drinking any guys under the table, but But I was so excited that my sister was proud of me. And more importantly, it taught me that that's the goal when you drink, right? You are trying to drink everyone else under the table. So, like, I am not someone who ever switched liquor stores to hide how much I drank. I wore it as a badge of honor. You know, I wanted you. I wanted everyone to know how much alcohol I could consume, you know. And I didn't get drunk a lot when I was little, but after that, I had kind of a strange obsession with alcohol. It's not strange for us, but for a four-year-old, it's a strange obsession, right? And what that strange obsession looked like is that, so my parents never, they didn't drink hard liquor, but my mother would, at the end of her day, she would watch television, Cagney and Lacey, Hill Street Blues, with a glass of red wine. And I would beg her for sips of that wine, and she would hold the glass. And let me tell you, my mom was thrifty, so she drank cheap red wine. I happen to love cheap red wine, right? And I love the sweetness of it. And she would hold the glass and just let me have a little bit. And when my father got home from work, he would drink a bottle of Coors Light. He would sit out. He had a folding chair. He would put it out on the driveway or the carport, depending on where we lived. And he would sit there with that beer, just kind of letting the day wash off him. And I would go out there and beg him for sips of his beer, and he would hold that bottle up and let me have the foam off the top. And that was it. When I was eight, my family moved to the Washington, D.C. area. And when I was 11, there was a series of events in my life that kind of changed the trajectory of my life. What happened first was that my father suffered a traumatic brain injury that left him completely incapacitated. And I was my daddy's little girl, so it was like literally one day I was there with my father, and then the next day he wasn't inside that body anymore. You know, it wasn't him. And it happened so suddenly, and it was so devastating to the family. And then the next thing that happened is that my mother was very focused on, as she should have been, you know, her husband and trying to help him get better. And there were a lot of people going in and out of our house, and my house became an unsafe place for 11-year-old girls. And I was raised Roman Catholic, but I lost my connection with God that year. And I remember I couldn't tell my mother what was happening to me because I was afraid to say it out loud. But I was able to tell my mother that I no longer believed in God and I didn't want to go to church anymore, which makes perfect sense to me as an adult why I would not have wanted to go to church anymore. But I'll tell you what happened, and it's something that I can see today that I couldn't see then, is that up and until that time, I lived a fairly God-centered life because that's how I was raised. When I lost that connection to God, when I stopped believing that God existed, the only alternative for me is to live a self-centered life. And I didn't know that I was self-centered until my first sponsor told me it, because I thought self-centered meant that you thought highly of yourself. You know, I didn't understand that it meant you thought a lot about yourself. But what happened to me untethered from God is that that's when I remember for the first time in my life feeling uncomfortable in my own skin. I have a sense of impending doom all of the time. And the largest impending doom isn't even around what's going on in my house. It's that I don't fit in with my friends, right? I am so afraid. And from the outside, it looks like I fit in. I'm in a lot of activities. I run around with a lot of kids. But inside, I have this knowledge that I'm not actually like them, and they're going to catch on. And I was in so much terror that people were going to realize and they would no longer be my friend. And what happened in the middle of that? Well, one thing that happened actually was that when I told my mother I didn't want to go to church anymore, my sweet Roman Catholic mother started to take me to other churches, hoping I would find God somewhere else. And one of the churches she took me to was called it was a Byzantine Catholic church. And when you got the first Holy Communion, they gave you a spoonful of red wine with a cube of bread in it. So I told her that I would attend that church. But that year, when I was 11, my girlfriend, one of my friends, Heather, her parents went out of the country for a week, and her high school sisters were babysitting her. And that weekend, Heather had a slumber party, and she had a bunch of little girls over that, I think it was Saturday night, and we were doing whatever 11-year-old girls do at slumber parties. But at some point, I walked into the kitchen by myself. I don't recall why, but what I remember were the high school sisters were sitting around the kitchen table, and they were drinking from a bottle that said Seagram 7. And I don't think that I had ever had hard liquor before, but I wanted to get drunk with the big girls. So I put my hands on my hips and I said, you know, I could drink you all under the table. And they laughed at me, but they gave me a liter of 7 and 7. And I remember standing in the kitchen that night. I remember I'd never seen a 1-liter bottle of soda before. And I remember tipping it back and just glug, 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 drinking it as fast as I could. I remember it was sweet. I liked the taste of it. And then nothing. I have no idea what happened the rest of the night. I want to tell you right now, there were no boys in the house. Nothing happened to me that night. But what I can tell you is my last recollection is standing in the kitchen with that bottle tipped up, drinking it as fast as I could, and then I can tell you how I came to the next morning, and that was on Heather's basement floor, which was unfinished. So I came to on a concrete floor. I was in a training bra. I had no other clothes or blanket. I remember feeling ashamed at having to walk through the house without clothing. I don't think anybody was up yet when I came to, because I think I'd remember the embarrassment of that. I do remember on the top floor in the hallway, I found my clothes, and when I picked them up, they were wet, and I realized why I had removed my clothing, but I couldn't remember any of that happening. I had to borrow some clothes from Heather to get home. I don't know why. I don't even know why I didn't have a second set, but I just remember Heather's green sweatpants and wearing those home. And the thing is, for me, when I don't black out every time I drink. I don't drink out of control every time I drink. The problem is, when I pick up a drink, I cannot control how much I drink or when I'm going to stop. So it might be okay when I pick up a drink, but all bets are off, and I have no idea how the night's going to end. So, you know, it just started, right? At 11, it clicked on for me, and I started looking for the kids whose parents had liquor cabinets who didn't pay attention to their children, and those were the kids I started hanging out with, and we'd wait till the parents went to sleep, and we'd start drinking, and now you know. Like, now you know why my mother started to send me to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13, and I thought, you know, I'd get caught from time to time. And I thought going to an AA meeting was like doing penance as a Catholic. You know, I got in trouble, this is my penance, and then it's all over. And I would just try harder not to get caught next time. The one thing I ever identified with in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't think I was identifying with it at the time, was the feeling of being different. Bill describes it in the 12 and 12. He has this perfect description, and he calls it anxious apartness. And I wouldn't have come up with that phrase myself, but when I read it, I thought that is the perfect description of how I felt from the time I lost God at 11. I feel apart from you and I'm anxious, right? Anxious apartness. That was my terminal condition. And alcohol does something for me, right? When I drink alcohol, maybe I don't care. It may be that I'm as good as you. It may be that I'm better than you. But whatever happens, I'm okay in my own skin, as long as I have a few drinks, right? But the one thing I identified with sometimes in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous was that feeling of being different from you. I just thought when I heard you talk about it that you guys, I understood that you felt like you were different, but you weren't. Like, you know, from all people. I just thought that there was something so defective about me. It was like me separate from the whole world. And so this, there is something wrong with me. And I started to think about like what it could be. And it occurred to me that probably what was wrong with me, my best idea of what was wrong with me, was that my parents had moved us from Los Angeles to DC. And my people aren't DC people. So if I could just move somewhere where my people are, then I would feel like I fit in. And I became obsessed with this idea. I thought if I could move back to Los Angeles, they would be my people because I felt comfortable there. But I also thought maybe if I could move to New York City, that's where my people are, right? So I ended up going to college. I was almost 18 years old when I went up to NYU, and I was so excited to be there. I was going up to NYU to study acting. The only problem with that was that I was supposed to go to class. And I meant to every day. For you younger people, in those days, you know, before we had anything online, you had to go to a bookstore and pick up your syllabi for your classes. It would tell you what books to buy, and it would tell you your assignments for the semester. And I would come to in the afternoon every day, and I would think, Yvonne, you have to go down to that bookstore. You've got to figure out your books, and you've got to catch up on your assignments. It is not too late, right? You still have time to do this, Yvonne. So tomorrow you're going to get up. Why it never occurred to me to just go right then, right? Isn't that funny? But no, it was going to be tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be a fresh day. I'm going to go do that. But since I'm going to do this tomorrow, I'm just going to go out and drinking one more night, and then I'm going to get serious, right? It was like, there was a speaker I loved, Hank Johnson. He would talk about Groundhog Day, right? It was like Groundhog Day for me. I just couldn't, you know, and after a semester, my mother was upset when I had to leave NYU, and I remember trying to explain to her, Mother, artists don't go to college anyway, you know, you know, I did end up on stage within a few months. My mother was not proud of the stage I was on. you know, and with that, and I never meant, like, it's just like one thing leads to another, and I didn't mean to go to one of those places anyways. I thought when they were looking for cocktail waitresses and dancers that it was like dinner theater, you know? I don't know. I had never been to 42nd and 8th before. Never been to Times Square in the 3 months that I lived in New York. And then it was just, I was just going to be a cocktail waitress. You know, like, I was mortified at the place, but then we'll just be a cocktail waitress. But, you know, I mean, just, it. And then I saw the cash. So that, you know, it took 3 days and a fifth of vodka is what that, you know. And I started, you know, like the dark desperation drinking. I was 18 years old, and I can't stand the light of day on what my life looks like. So I drink all the time. Like, I drink as much as I possibly can. And after about a year of that, I remember thinking, well, he left, and I remember just feeling so alone in my apartment and thinking, if I could just move back down with my mother for just like a few weeks, just calm down for a minute, you know, like just get my life straightened out, and then I could come back and do what I meant to do up here, you know. And I go back down to DC, and I detox in my mom's house, as a matter of fact, and then I started looking for work, and I got a job as a bartender in an area called Adams Morgan. And I had this idea, like, this was going to be so fun. I was 19 years old, and I was like, this is like fun. This is like the clubs, right? Like, this isn't the dark strip club drinking, right? Like, this is, people are going out and having a good time. It's going to look different, you know. But that's not what it looks like, because I cannot control what happens whenever I pick up a drink. And within a couple of months of that, I mean, dark desperation drinking, I am getting loaded all the time. And within a couple of months of that, I discover that I'm pregnant. And my first thought, was uh-oh, in the sense that I'd, you know, been up to no good, you know, the things that were not good for a baby. But the next thought I had was, this is what I've been looking for, right? So the thing that happened, like, when I moved to New York, I thought I would find my people and I would fit in, and I didn't. I felt like a poser in New York City, the same way I felt like a poser in the DC area, right? The moment I found out I was pregnant, I thought, this child is going to love me with all of her heart. I will love her with all of my heart. She will make me feel like a whole person. That's what I thought. I thought, I was 19 years old. I was so immature that I thought having a baby would make me feel like a whole person. So I saw a doctor 4 days later for the first time, and that doctor told me that I was 2 months along. And I was like, uh-oh, like, let me tell you what I've done over this last 2 months, which was a lot of bad, right? And I asked her what was going to happen to this baby. And she said, and let me tell you something. 4 days before the day I found out I was pregnant, I quit drinking and whatever else. I quit smoking cigarettes because I'm going to be a good mother. You know, I'm going to have a healthy baby. I'm going to be a good mom. And that doctor told me that we still had a heartbeat, so probably everything would be fine. And she asked me if I needed help. And I said, I quit 4 days ago, you know, and you could have brought in, I believe, a polygraph that day, and I think I could have passed it, because I don't know what kind of a woman would get loaded pregnant, but I am not that kind of a woman, right? So, and I can tell you that I stayed physically sober for a period of time. I don't know how long it was, because when I wasn't physically sober, I was too ashamed, right, to think about it that much, but I think I was somewhere between 5 and 7 months pregnant when I had a bad week. That's how immature I am. But what I don't understand is that I have no mental defense against the first drink. I think being pregnant is the defense I need, right? I don't even understand I'm alcoholic, right? And so I had a bad week. It seemed like everything happened in that week. He left, the car got totaled, my job, I was demoted because they didn't want a pregnant woman behind the bar, you know. And I remember taking a cab to my place. It was not in a great neighborhood. And every day I would take that cab or my car when I still had it, and I would get out and go right in my place, right? And this particular night, I remember seeing the group of guys on the corner, and I just thought, you know, I'm just going to go say hello to them. And then I remember thinking, like, that isn't what you're doing. And I remember thinking, you know what you're doing. And then my next thought was, I don't care. But it isn't true that I didn't care. I cared very deeply what I was doing to my child. I just didn't have the words to say. I had no power that night. And that night I began to get loaded with a desperation I'd never experienced before, because I could not stand being physically sober, knowing what I was doing to this little girl. And it escalated, it spiraled out of control. Now I can't see a doctor because you can tell right away what I'm up to. And every day I'm thinking, what's going to happen? Like, is she going to be removed from my custody? Is she going to die? Am I killing her? Is she, if I stop, will she die? If I keep, like, what? I couldn't figure it out. And 2 weeks before my due date, somewhere around, so, you know, Christmas Eve, my brother got married, and I was getting loaded in the bathroom at his wedding because I could not go that many hours. The first work day after Christmas, I showed up at a doctor who didn't even need me to say a word to know what I was up to. And that doctor helped me for the last few weeks of my pregnancy, rather. And when my daughter was born, my daughter had to detox in the neonatal intensive care unit for 16 days. And I didn't mean to do that to her. I didn't. And, you know, and I felt bad for her, but at the same time, I really didn't think it was my fault. Like, if you'd asked me why it happened, I could give you a series of things that had happened to me that made me take the action I took. And if the world would just be nice to me, if my parents, my mother, if my mother would get off my back. It's funny now with the space of age and time. When I look back at how my mother was during my pregnancy, I cannot think of a single way she could have been more supportive of me, right? But in my skin at that time, I could not see it that way, right? So it was not my fault. This happened to me. And I'll tell you, if the only thing that I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous is personal responsibility for my actions, I'm overpaid. Because I didn't realize that if everyone else was responsible for what actions I took, I would never be a free human being, right? I am so grateful to AA for the freedom I have today. Unfortunately for my daughter, she was released to me at 16 days old. It was February in Washington, D.C., and 3 days later, we were living in places that had no doors, windows, running water, or electricity. And I lived like that with that little girl for the first 9 months of her life. And I was working for an escort service at the beginning of that. I got fired because I couldn't show up to work sober, and they cared. I was I was staying with this woman, Tawana, who would watch my daughter when I went to work for the escort service, and I told Tawana I'd just been fired, and I needed to make some money, and I was trying to figure out what I could do, and she said it was not a problem because her brother Buttons was a pimp, and we could walk down to a payphone and page her brother, and I could go to work for him. And that wasn't the evening I had in mind, but I had no better ideas that day. And so we walked down to a payphone, paged Buttons. He came and picked me up, and he took me on a street corner in D.C. and explained to me how business works out on the street, because I had never been out there. And Johnny was talking earlier about Norm Alpe's Seconds and Inches, and this night was my Seconds and Inches night, because it would have changed the course of my life. I got into a car that night, but I never took any money from the guy, because we couldn't agree upon my value. And... the negotiations were going on so long that an undercover car put on lights and did that, you know, megaphone step out of the vehicle thing, and I stepped out of that car saying, "It's not what you think." And they frisked me, and I didn't have a dollar on me, so they could not arrest me for prostitution. But the officer told me he knew what I was doing out there, and he said if he saw me again on the street that night, he would arrest me for prostitution, whether I had a dollar or not. And Buttons told me I was bringing a little too much police heat to his corner that night, and he said to go back to his sister's place, and he would come by in the morning, and we could try again, and he said he would send someone with a little money in a few minutes, or in a little while, I don't know what it was. But I remember I went back to Tawana's place, and nobody came with any money, and I didn't have any. I remember being really sick all night, and my daughter was really sick too, like very sick. I was completely incapable of taking care of her because I was either sick or loaded, right? And all I can tell you is I walked down to a payphone at 7:15 in the morning. 7:15 because that was when my mother left for work in the morning, and I knew that was the last minute I could get her before she left for work. I was too ashamed to speak to my mother because I had been disappeared for a few months, and every time I disappeared, she knew what I was up to, and she knew that her infant grandchild was in my custody. When I heard her voice on the other end of the line, all I said to her was, "If you bring me $20, I will let you have the baby." And my mother brought me $20 that morning, and I lost custody of my daughter, and I am so grateful for that today. My mother took my daughter to a doctor immediately after she got her, who diagnosed this infant, 9-month-old infant, with double bronchitis. The doctor told my mother that my daughter would not have survived a couple of more days without medical treatment, and I'm so grateful that I did not kill my child out there. I spent what I hope are the last 3.5 months of my drinking. I didn't get to see my daughter in that period of time. Nobody trusted me with that child, as you know, as was appropriate, right? In that 3.5 month period of time, I missed my daughter's first Christmas, her first birthday, her first words, and her first steps. And my mother, I got a job at another strip club on the block in Baltimore where they had back rooms for the customers to take the girls. My mother tracked me down at that club. She called them until she found the one I worked at, right? Poor mother. And she offered me a deal. My mother had found a facility for mothers and babies. It was inpatient 1 year. And she said they had a bed open, and if I was willing to come, I could have custody of my daughter back from day one. And if I said no, she understood, but she wanted me to know that she would do everything in her power to make sure I never saw my daughter again. I am so grateful to my mother for that. My mother is like the sweetest, most gentle human being I've ever met in my life. And I hated her. My mother was mature enough to face my hate, you know, in order to try to save my life. And certainly if she couldn't save mine, to save the life of her granddaughter, right? I was angry at my mother, but I really wanted to see my daughter, and so I agreed to go. I checked into a detox first. I don't count detox in my sobriety. They gave me a lot of stuff. I brought a little extra because I felt like they never give you enough. I know I ran out sometime that week, and I know that that the day I got out of treatment on February 10th, 1994, that I was as physically sober as I am today. So that's my sobriety date. That's also the date that I got custody of that little girl back. She was 13 months old, maybe 13 months, 10 days, somewhere right around there. She was holding on to my mother, screaming for her mommy. And she wasn't talking about me. She didn't know who I was anymore. She didn't want me to touch her. And that's what my life looked like on my first day of sobriety. And you would think I would be grateful for the opportunity I had. You'd be wrong. I was really angry. I felt like everybody overreacted, which seems obscene now, right? But I thought everyone overreacted. If the world would just treat me right, everything would be okay. And I went through this facility angry. So I went through this facility. It was like, I'm so grateful to them. They hear from me every year on my birthday. I thank them every year. If you're new, I want to say that I'm so grateful to that facility for giving me a safe place to live with this child for a year, for giving me parenting classes, those kinds of things. But I always like to be clear that everything I've learned about how to stay sober and how to be successful in life, I've learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I got to that treatment facility, it was like a federal program. They had a lot of rules around who could watch children. And long story short, we couldn't get out to very many meetings. We only got about out to about 2 AA meetings a month. And we didn't have them in. I don't know why that wasn't a thing there like we have in California, but it was not a thing. We got out to about 2 AA meetings a month. And I always felt like that's an awful lot of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like I need 2 meetings a month. If I feel like I need one, I'll let you know, you know? And I would always offer to stay home because I'm not, like, lame, right? But they would make me go. And I would tell them, like, I always told them the whole time, you guys are wasting your breath on me because when I get out of here, I am not going to AA, just so you know. And when I was 11 months sober, I was at a local Alano club, and there was a table out that had flyers of local area events. So the flyer for this ice cream social would have been there, right? And there was a flyer out, and I didn't know what it was. I know today it was something called CIRCIPA, which was the Southeast Regional Conference of Young People in AA. I had never heard Young People in AA or PA or anything like that. I'd never heard it. I had no idea what it was. I didn't know young people got sober in AA. Like, I thought, you know, obviously I was young. I was 21 when I got sober. Occasionally at other meetings, the meetings we went to, sometimes I saw another young person, but I assumed that they, like me, were being forced sober. It never occurred to me anybody would willingly be sober while they were young, you know. And so, you know, I didn't know what that was. All I know when I looked at this flyer is they were having a spaghetti dinner and that they had a main speaker that night, and it was going to be a man named Sandy Beach. And when I was in detox a couple of times, there was this detox I went to. Sandy used to live in the DC area, and he would do this 12-step workshop on Saturday mornings called Saturday Morning Live. And a detox I rotated out of a couple of times used to take us on the druggy buggy there on Saturday mornings to hear Sandy. And I remember it because here's the thing. So I was so obnoxious when I was new. I was so obnoxious. I'm so grateful we didn't have cell phones in those days because I would have, like, been distracting everyone with my cell phone in a meeting. What I did, because I wanted you all to know how contemptuous I was of your stupid meeting I had to attend. You know, I was like a little thing then, and I would, like, pull my knees up and put my arms around and put my head down and sleep so you would know I'm not interested. Where Sandy spoke, it was in a theater. In an auditorium, and there were theater-style seats, and I remember they were really comfy. It was my favorite seat at the meetings we went to. But I heard something Sandy said one morning because I heard myself laugh out loud. I didn't know what it was, but I heard myself laugh out loud, and the reason I remember it was because my immediate reaction to that was like, oh, lame. Like, don't laugh in AA. That's so stupid, you know? And I remembered his funny name, Sandy Beach, right? So when I'm 11 months sober and I see that flyer, this man, Sandy Beach, is going to be speaking, I had this thought. I hadn't been to a speaker meeting in that time. And I had this thought. I thought, that's the man who made me laugh. And I wondered why. Like, how could someone make me laugh in an AA meeting? Right? And so I picked up that flyer and I went back to my treatment facility, and for the first time in my life, I asked permission to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave it to me, and I showed up at that meeting. I don't even remember how I got there, but I showed up at that meeting and I walked in the room, and I don't even remember Sandy being there that night. I remember it being a room of about 200 young people, and they were busy. It was like a beehive of activity. They were serving spaghetti and they were running around. They were like, people were dressed nice, and I was like, what is this? Like, how are all these young people, like, with smiles on their faces, you know? And there were a lot of cute boys there. And I was 22 with 11 months sober, so I thought, if I have to go to meetings, it's here, you know? A bunch of young ladies came and gave me their phone number, and they told me to give them a call. And 3 months later, I got out of treatment, and I called them. Another crazy thing that I actually called them, and it was... It was the conference, the Young People's Conference was that weekend, and this young lady, Jennifer, told me to meet her at a certain time in this this hotel lobby in Arlington, Virginia. And when she met me there, she brought me in, and she was smart enough to, like, time it so that I came after the banquet. I mean, maybe they were even sold out of banquet tickets, or she intuitively knew I couldn't afford a banquet ticket, whatever it was. We need to be self-supporting at conferences, but I had no money, so... she just pulled up an extra chair at that table, and the speaker was a woman named Karen Garrison from Venice, California, and she had me laughing the entire time. And then for some reason, I went to a meeting with these kids again the next night, and then I did it the next night, and then I did it the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And that woman, Jennifer, young lady Jennifer, would ask me every night at one of those meetings, she would say, do you have a sponsor yet? And I would lie and say, I'm looking. No, I wasn't looking. I had zero interest in sponsorship. I hadn't asked you exactly what it was, but I had an idea. It would be like, you know, like I'd walk up to Sammy and say, hi, Sammy, will you be my mommy? And then I have to ask her permission to do anything. And then if it's fun, she's going to say no, right? Like, no, thank you. I don't need that. So... that was a mistake, because after like a month of doing that, Jennifer actually appointed herself to me. She told me she was going to be my sponsor, and that's when I realized what an error in judgment I had made, because if I had lined up every young woman in my meeting, Jennifer would have been my very last choice for a sponsor. And she was exactly what I needed when I was new. Jennifer was mean. Mean. Let me tell you something. Like, I used to say to Jennifer, like, well, I feel like, and she would say, I don't care how you feel. Oh my God, I've never had someone tell me they don't care how I feel. Here's the thing, newcomer, I would say it differently myself. I have a different style than Jennifer does, although I can be hard too. But I have a different style than Jennifer does. But here's what she was trying to teach me, was that up until that time, I lived my entire life based on my feelings, right? And look at my results. They were terrible. I had to learn how to live life on a basis other than how I felt about things. My mom didn't wake up in the morning and think, oh, I don't feel like going to work today. Like, she might not have felt like going to work today. It was never a consideration that she wouldn't just get up and go to work, right? I literally thought my feelings mattered as to what actions I would take. And my sponsor and my home group trained my feet differently, that just to disregard how I felt about things, you know. Another thing, so when I got out of that treatment facility, I moved into the projects. I was on TANF, you know, food stamps, like back then when they were actually the tear out things in front of everyone, the big WIC check with the peanut butter and the cheese and the stuff. And my sponsor told me, she told me, I was going to a meeting every night, but she told me I had to go to a meeting every night, and I wasn't planning on continuing it, right? I mean, especially once I found a boyfriend, but she told me that I had to go to a meeting every night, and I told her, I can't go to a meeting every night, I have a 2-year-old, and she said, I didn't ask your opinion. wasn't sure what you say to that, because she was right. I mean, she had not, in fact, asked my opinion. I didn't know what to say. And it was so wild, because, like, I'd been scrappy on the street, let me tell you something. And for some reason, this girl who got sober her senior year of high school, who was, like, a year older than me and had four more years than me, for some reason, she intimidated me. And let me tell you something, I needed to be intimidated. I really did. I was a wild one. And so the fact that I had a sponsor that intimidated me was exactly what I needed. It took me a while to get some words together, and then I asked her, like, how do I do this? Like, if a babysitter was $1 a night, it might as well be $1,000 a night, because I don't have $30 of my TANF check for babysitting in a month, right? So I was like, how do I do this? And she told me how I would do it, and I'm so grateful. You know, I had to bring my daughter to meetings every day. She was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody showed me the 12 Traditions Illustrated pamphlet, and first tradition, our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And there's a drawing of a drunk man who's disrupting a meeting, and he cannot stay in the meeting while he's disrupting it. He's welcome back another time, but he can't stay and disrupt the meeting. And I was told the same thing applied to my child. If she was disrupting the meeting, we had to exit, right? Because other people would need to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I learned to sit in the back near the door, much like that baby is today, right? I spent a lot of meetings on my stomach on the floor with a coloring book with my daughter, because if I was coloring with her, then she felt like I was paying attention to her when I was listening to a speaker, right? And then as people got to know her, some of the other young ladies would take her out sometimes when she got too wild so I could sit in the meeting and not worry about it, you know? And then my daughter became, you know, it didn't take too long for my daughter to become what I like to call meeting trained, which is like, my daughter was wild, right? Like wild, but as soon as the meeting started, she would sit quietly with her Polly Pockets and just play quietly during the meeting, and then as soon as the meeting was over, she was wild again, and everyone loved her. She was the mascot of the meeting, you know. And I did not get better right away. I'm sure that comes as a surprise to many of you. I brought a lot of old habits into Alcoholics Anonymous. I also thought of AA and sponsorship kind of like an extracurricular activity. It's like what I do for this period of my evening, and I'm not going to invite you into the rest of my life. And I looked around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could clearly see what my problem was. It's not alcoholism, just so you know. I mean, I might be alcoholic, but my problem isn't alcoholism. My problem is poverty. So if I could just make enough money, then I would feel good, right? Like everything would be okay. And I started to think, like, how can I make money? How can I make money? And then I remembered I'd been fired from an escort service because I wasn't sober, but I'm sober now. Should I talk to my sponsor about this? God, no. Like, no. What does she know? Like, her mother paid half her rent for her. Like, she had, like, she didn't have a kid. She doesn't know. And I mean, why is it even illegal? We're all consenting adults. It's none of the government's business anyway. My sponsor said I live like ready, fire, aim. So I had this worked out in my head. So I went back to work for an escort service with a year sober, with no thought at all to putting my child at risk in her bedroom, right? And what I can tell you over the next few months is that it ate my soul, right? And I never even wanted to pick up a drink, although it became clear to me that I was going to drink if I was going to keep living like that. But I didn't think about drinking. What I fantasized about was buying a gun, right? I wanted lights out. And I'll tell you, I am so grateful. I don't recommend this. I'm grateful for the experience, because at about 18 months of sobriety was when I finally surrendered. Because you guys, I didn't trust my sponsor. I didn't. But at 18 months of sobriety, it became clear to me that my sponsor couldn't possibly do a worse job with my life than I was doing myself. And that was all I needed to surrender. And I treated it like an experiment. Like, I will let you have my life. You can direct me. And then we'll see. I can always kill myself later, right? And I turned myself over to her and became willing to do anything she asked me to do. And I am so grateful. I know today that it doesn't even matter what the direction is. It's the surrender that does it for us, right? So my sponsor gave me a couple of directions. One was that, so I had this other problem. I was diagnosed, and I'm only sharing my experience. My experience is not necessarily going to be yours, but the only thing I have of value value in Alcoholics Anonymous is my experience. I suffered from heavy depression. It was a clinical diagnosis. But what happened is that if you sat next to me and asked me how I was, I would suck the life out of you with my answer. It always involved a lot of crying. I felt sorry for myself all of the time. No one else in my home group of 200 people lived in the projects. No one else was a single mother. No one else, it was just blah, 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 blah. A woman in my home group, a young lady in my home group, once when I was crying to her, looked at me and said, "You know, Yvonne, I hope I'm not sitting next to you when you get what you deserve." Those are those statements you hear, right, sometimes when you're laying in bed late at night, that you really know that they're right, right? Because my problem was perspective, right? Clancy would call it the disease of perception. I thought I had a bad life. In reality, everything was exactly as it should have been. Like, first of all, who gives someone like me custody of a child back? I know plenty of women who did much less than I did to their children who never got them back. Just right there, just that one thing, I was way overpaid, right? I'm living in an apartment that I get to stay in for free. It's safe, right? I have food stamps. We have food on the table at all times. Like, all the things I felt sorry for me about for myself were all blessings, and I just couldn't see it that way at the time, right? But my sponsor told me, she told me when I surrendered to her and became willing to follow whatever direction she gave me, she told me that I was no longer allowed to tell people how I was. She told me she wanted me to start smiling and pretend to be a happy person. And then if somebody asked me how I was to lie to them and tell them I was fine. And then I had to ask them questions that she wrote down to pretend like I was interested in their day, right? Fine. And I remember when I started doing it, it felt so fake, right? Like, so stupid, that smile. But I can tell you that I started to do it, and I didn't even think the direction was for me. I thought she was giving me that direction so that I wouldn't bother you guys anymore, right? I was wrong about that, because I can tell you, I don't know when I realized it, but at some point, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 18 months, I realized that I was no longer depressed. That direction changed how I embraced life, right? I started to act as if I was a joyful person, and then I became a joyful person. I was no longer living life like a heavy garment, right? Life was light. And it's not like sometimes things happen and I feel deep sadness at times, but I know too, it's okay. In life, we experience all kinds of feelings, fear, anger, right? All of these things, they pass, they all pass. But I know that if I keep my feet marching forward, that everything is going to be okay, right? So when the escort service thing didn't work out, I didn't think I'd ever be able to move out of the projects. I thought, like, if you'd asked me to write my life goal, it would have been move out of the projects. I had a deep sense of shame about living in the projects, and I didn't think it would be possible for someone like me until my child was 18, right? And my best thought after the prostitution didn't work out was to go to junior college. I'd never been a good student, but maybe I can get a two-year degree in something and find a job somehow. So I go to school. But I'm trained in Alcoholics Anonymous now, right? I'm trained, if my child's not with me, to sit up front, right? To be there on time, to stay the whole time. I don't get up and walk around. I don't get up and go to the bathroom during a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I don't. I don't do it during class either, right? I do my homework. I do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it. I go to the professor when I don't understand something and I ask questions about it, right? That was my AA training, and it turns out that that's also really good school and work training, because if you apply those things to school and work, you become a successful student and employee. And so I apply that to school, and my first semester, I had two classes, and I got A's in both of them. I was like, oh, what is happening here, and then the next semester, I took four classes and straight A's again, and then four and four and four, and I'm straight A's the whole time. And towards the end of my 2 years, my school counselor tells me to apply to to college. And my thought was, like, a girl like me? And I asked him, I was like, you mean like apply to the state school? And he said, Yvonne, I think you could go anywhere you want to go. And I had this thought about, there was a doctor's office that I used to go to when I was at the end of my pregnancy. And it was in a part of DC called Foggy Bottom, which is where the George Washington University campus was. And I would go and see this doctor. And I remember on Saturday mornings, I would walk from the metro to the doctor's office, and I would walk down Frat Row, and I would see like all the beer bottles and stuff from the Friday night parties the night before. And I was 19 years old, and I would think, like, I'm the same age as these kids. Like, how did my life get so different? And I had some kind of dream about GW, and I applied to the George Washington University, and I was accepted there on academic scholarship. And 2 years later, I graduated from GW first in my field. And I want you to know, newcomer, my sponsor wouldn't let me go to fewer than 7 meetings a week because she said I was too crazy. I didn't need any time on my hands. So I had to learn to be very efficient with my time because I was in school full-time on academic scholarship. I also worked part-time. I had, you know, a toddler by myself, and I went to a meeting every night. And that efficiency has really served me well in my career, let me tell you something. So I graduated first in my field. My mom got to sit on the White House lawn with my daughter was 5 when I graduated from the university, with Caitlin on her lap, and I'm so grateful that my mom finally got her scholar and got to see that. My mom was diagnosed with cancer shortly after that, and she died within a very brief period of time. But my mother lived long enough to see me turn 5 years sober. And she told me that she knew that her granddaughter was safe in my custody because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she also saw me start my first year of law school. I got to tell you, I went to a really conservative law school in Virginia when I graduated college. And I sat in that room looking around thinking, I know I'm the only hooker in here. I never shared that with them, though. I did that, and I really wanted to move back to Los Angeles. When I graduated law school, I moved back to LA, and I sat for the bar there. And here's the thing, like, so now I'm like 7 years sober, my daughter's 8 years old, and I've graduated law school, and it's such an incredible, successful story, right? And I move out to Los Angeles, and everything is going to be great now. And I didn't go to law school in California, so I don't know California law, and I can't afford a bar review course. But I'm a good student; it's going to be fine, which was great until I failed the bar exam, right? And then what that did for me, you guys, is it solidified what I believed about myself, right? Yeah, Yvonne, why did you ever think you could be a lawyer anyway? You're not that kind of a girl. Of course you failed the bar exam, you know, and I was waiting tables, and I just gave up. And I didn't talk to my sponsor about it because it was too shameful for me to talk about how I thought about myself, right? And my sponsor, after it took like maybe 18 months, maybe even 2 years for my sponsor to realize I was still waiting tables and I hadn't become a lawyer, and then she like just pulled the covers down, right? And she was like, you know, she told me what I was going to do, and what I was going to do, or I was going to get another sponsor. Because Yvonne, if you wanted to be a server your whole life, I would support you, but that's not why you went to law school, right? And she made me take a series of actions, and I'll tell you, one of them was, she told me I had to get a job in a law firm. The only problem with that was that the only job I was offered in a law firm was a legal secretary because I could type fast. And I went back to her to explain to her that the only job I was offered was a legal secretary, so obviously I can't take that. And she quickly disavowed me of that idea. She told me I would take that job, and I thought, you crazy bat. Like, I didn't say it because my sponsor was scary. Let me tell you, scary. A different sponsor than my first one, but my friend Kenna would say you could feel the frost come over the phone, you know? She scared the bejesus out of me, and just, it was perfect. And she told me I would take that job, and I was so angry inside about it. And let me just tell you how wrong I was, right? So I took this job as a legal secretary at this firm, and a couple of weeks, and I show up like the way I'm supposed to, and I'm a good worker because I'm trained to be a good worker, and then I become friendly with the office manager, and she hears about my background, and like 2 weeks into this, they fire a paralegal, and then she hires me as the paralegal, right? And then I'm doing that, and then I had an opportunity. There were like a bunch of files that came in, and nobody was working on them, so I went in one weekend and did this work and left them on the boss's desk. And then he called me in on Monday morning and like, what, did you do this? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, you can write? I'm like, I'm a lawyer. I just have to pass the bar, right? And so he fronted money for me to take a bar review course. And then I took the bar review course, and then I passed the California bar. Of course I did, right? And then here's the crazy thing is that that firm that she made me take the job at was like this weird niche practice of law. That I became extremely successful at, so much so that like 5 years ago, I was recruited by the largest global law firm that practices this area. It's based in London, but we have offices all over the world, right? They recruited me to come work at them. I was like, meet, like, I'm gonna go work at like a bit, like, do you guys don't know who I am, do you? And they don't know who I am. They don't. They think I'm like churchy or something. Those guys, they cuss in front of me and then they apologize, like. But I don't cuss in front. I've learned not to cuss in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I don't do it at work either. And I don't mind. And I'll tell you, like I became a shareholder there last year. And to me, it is wild, you know. And I'm on like a bunch of committees. They think I'm like this stellar human being, and I am because of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? They've tapped into that the being of service that we have here in AA, you know, And I got to raise that little girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful for that, because I want you to know she gave me a run for my money. she really, God, it was rough. My daughter would like disappear on the streets of Venice. I wouldn't be able to find her. I mean, when she was like 12 years old, she was out there hard, hardcore. But my daughter came to me in 2008, in the summer of 2008, and she needed to tell me something. She was really afraid, and I was like, oh, here it goes, I'm going to be a grandma. But no, what she was going to tell me was that she was sober 30 days in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my daughter was 15 years old, and her sobriety date is June 21st, 2008, so she just recently celebrated 16 years of sobriety, and I'm so grateful, and she and I are super close. We both, it's funny, last year I was secretary of our home group, the Pacific Group, and then she became secretary of our Monday night Ohio, you know, street meeting, and it's the first time in my home group that, it, like, family has been secretary at the same time, and it's just the sweetest thing to have this child that's active, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I want to tell you that I told you I lost my connection to God. I didn't find it just because I got sober. I just didn't believe in God. And when I was 2.5 years sober, I was at an airport, and we, you know, the old boarding passes with the cardstock. I had that in my hand, and I was not careful, and I jerked my hand up. I didn't wear glasses then, and what happened is I sliced off some of my cornea with that boarding pass. I know. I got on a plane, and when I got to the other side, I thought it was hurt, obviously. I was in an extraordinary amount of pain, but I thought it would go away. And it, anyways, I got to the ER, and they explained to me what happened, and it should heal within a couple of days. Corneal tissue heals really quickly, but it didn't. That hole kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I developed necrotizing bacteria in the eye. I was in the most extraordinary amount of pain. I couldn't sleep at all. I had to put eye drops in my eye every half an hour, 24 hours a day, and I did not have to set an alarm clock to wake me up 30 minutes. Because I couldn't sleep that long because of the physical pain I was in. And one night I saw a doctor. I had to see a doctor every single day. And on Saturday, this doctor told me, it was like evening by the time he got to me. And he told me, Yvonne, there's nothing more I can do for you. 50-50, you're going to lose that eye altogether in the next week. And I was totally devastated by that. But I also felt like I couldn't go like another 24 hours in that much pain. So that night I made a decision, a secret decision, that the next day I was going to go down to Southeast DC and buy some like opiates of some kind, specifically because I wanted a pain blocker. But I wasn't going to share it with anyone because I didn't want anyone to make me feel guilty about making that decision. And what happened that night is a woman came to me unsolicited. It was my first sponsor, actually. She came to me unsolicited and told me what I needed to do when I got home was pray for the removal of the obsession I had with my eye. And I've never wanted to kill someone more than I wanted to kill her. And I was so angry, and I remember laying in bed seething. You know, like where you're so mad at someone, you start screaming at them in your own room, you know? It was like that. And then that voice in my head was like, just get out and pray. Like, and that, like, stupid. That's so stupid. But finally, I just decided to do it so the argument would stop. And I don't know what I said, but I got on my knees, and it was something like, God, please remove the obsession I have with my eye, whatever. And I crawled back into bed and went to sleep, and when I woke up, it was 6 hours later. And I knew significant time had passed because there was light in the room. And then I realized that I was no longer in pain. Mild, very tiny amount of pain. Essentially, I was no longer in pain. And I woke up that morning filled with the feeling of God. And for me, it felt like coming home. When I woke up that morning, I knew for the first time since I was 11 years old that God, in fact, existed. God exists. And I remembered what it felt like to be close with God. It feels like the same feeling as joy to me. I feel it here. And that started my relationship with God. It's one that I work on consistently now. But I got that moment. And it also taught me the greatest lesson I've ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that that I thought what I was going through was a bad thing. Like, I went blind in my eye. I'm still blind in my left eye. I felt really sorry for myself. I was in pain all the time, dragged on for months and months. But from what I judged to be a terrible experience, I received the greatest gift I've ever gotten, which was that knowledge that God exists. And then that taught me that I cannot judge what is good or bad in my life because I have no idea. So it tells myself, like, I don't handle everything gracefully. But what I know is that whatever I'm going through in the moment, I know that my perspective is off, right? And that when I look at it later, it's going to be okay, right? You know, and I'll tell you, the one other piece is I was single the most of my sobriety. My sponsor told me when my daughter was young, I could not have men go in and out of her life. And I was busy with school and stuff anyways. Just a couple of years ago, I got asked to do a commitment like this. I was a last-minute fill-in for someone who had cancer, as a matter of fact. And I showed up, and there was a guy there who was supposed to speak there 2 years before, but it got canceled because of COVID, and then canceled the next year again. And then he was there, and we ended up boy meets girl on AA campus, I gotta tell you. And there was like my best friend Kenna calls it sparking. We had a sparking. And then I went to my sponsor and said, what do I do? I want my sponsor to direct me, right? I don't want to be directed out of self-will. We did. He was from St. Louis, I was from LA. It seemed like, I mean, what are we even doing here? But it ended up, We did it long distance for a year, and then a year ago, you know. Anyways, I'm now engaged, and ladies, if you're single, it was worth the wait. And I'll tell you, everything that is good in my life is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.